I'm going to admit everybody. Pam, I'm starting. Good morning. This is Judge Spector. I'm going to caption the case. Hang on before people start speaking. Let me assure you, we are on the record. Our voices are going to be recorded in the official court recording system. However, there's no one actually in the courtroom except for my bailiff and my clerk. However, the courtroom doors are unlocked. Anybody can walk in here as long as they're wearing a mask and they are socially distanced at 6 feet. Governor Inslee, Chief Justice Stevens, and President Trump have all declared a state of emergency due to the COVID-19 health crisis. The parties and members of the public have been provided access to this virtual courtroom through teleconferencing in a Zoom platform. Currently, there are 56 people in the Zoom call. It is visual and audio. Everyone is muted unless they are speaking. The only people who will be allowed to speak are the parties and their attorneys, and it will be through counsel. Before we begin, I'm going to make the following findings before I have everybody identify themselves. This case is known as the family of Demarius Butts and Dow Constantine et Anno. It's consolidated under 20-2-014206 SEA. It's consolidated with the family of Isaiah Obet and Dow Constantine et al. That's 20-2-014133. The City of Seattle and Dow Constantine were in the case, but I am still obligated to caption their cause number. It is 20-2-014559. The other matter is Myers et al. Versus King County Executive Office and others. That cause number is 20-2-02220-9. I'm going to have each attorney, starting with the attorneys for the family of Demarius Butts, unmute yourself and identify yourselves for the record, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is LaRon Baker for the family of Demarius Butts.
Good morning, counsel. You can mute yourself if you're not.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Mr.
I apologize.
Go ahead.
Good morning. This is Adrian Levitt, also for the family of Demarius Butts.
Good morning to both counsel. So a couple of rules. If you're not speaking, please mute yourself. Thank you. Next, for the attorney for the family of Isaiah Obet, would you identify yourself for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Amy Parker. I'm counsel for Isaiah Obet, the family of Isaiah Obet.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
And right. Good morning, Your Honor. Cindy Silvello, also counsel for the family of Isaiah Obet.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. Next, we have the attorneys for the maternal family of Charlena Lyles. And let me just say this, these are not the personal representatives of the family, of the estate of Charlena Lyles, but these are interveners. Could counsel please identify themselves?
Good morning, Your Honor. Corey Gelmet on behalf of the family of Charlena Lyles.
Good morning, Your Honor. Prachi Dave, also on behalf of the maternal family of Charlena.
Good morning, counsel. Nice to see you. Next, we have the attorney for the City of Auburn, City of Kent, Special Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County Sheriff's Office, Mr. Estes.
Good morning, Your Honor. Stuart Estes for interveners, as you indicated.
Thank you. Next, we have the attorneys for Christopher Myers, Elizabeth Kennedy, Joshua Vaga, Xavier Gordillo.
Good morning, Your Honor. Evan Burial on behalf of the identified officers.
All right. Thank you. Next, we have the attorney for officers Stephen McNew and Jason Anderson.
Good morning, Your Honor. Karen Cobb on behalf of the officers.
All right. Thank you, counsel. I hope I have the order correct as of yesterday's email that you sent. Next, we have the attorney for the City of Federal Way.
Good morning, Your Honor. Tom Miller, attorney for the City of Federal Way.
All right. Very good. Next, we have the attorney for the administrator, retired Judge Michael Spearman.
Good morning, Your Honor. Kim Feiler on behalf of Administrator Spearman. Also with me on the call this morning is my colleague, Austin Galena.
All right, thank you. And I understand Judge Spearman is in the call as well. All right. Next, we have the attorneys for King County Executive Dow Constantine and King County Inquest Administrator Michael Spearman.
Morning, Your Honor. Samantha Kenner on behalf of the King County Executive Dow Constantine in his official capacity.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honor. Tom Couple, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, also here on behalf of the Executive Constantine.
All right. Very well. We have nine parties. Lots of lawyers. I'm going to make some Bone Club findings pursuant to State versus Bone Club at 128 Washington 2nd, 254, 1995 case. For purposes of today's hearing, I'm going to make the following findings. A compelling interest has been demonstrated that requires that the court take such measures as to conduct hearings scheduled for today via teleconference and to limit physical public interaction with the parties and court staff. The courtroom is open. I will note that it is unlocked. The court has determined that the current state of emergency requires that this hearing be held telephonically with a notice that has been sent out to all the parties, and we're free to forward it to their friends, family, or anybody of interest, that there would be a virtual audio courtroom. It's also been placed on the General Courts Departmental website. This notice contains instructions on how the parties and members of the public may dial in to this virtual audio conference room with a conference Zoom invitation. The court has weighed the importance of open proceedings against the present health risks and has determined that the risk of further spread of COVID-19 outweighs the interest of the public to be physically present in open courts. Court finds that the means provided for the public and parties to participate in this court hearing is the least restrictive means available for protecting the public, the parties, and court staff. The court has weighed the importance of open proceedings against the present health risks and has determined that it is appropriate to defer to the guidance of public health experts during this pandemic. The risk of further spread of COVID-19 outweighs the interest of the public to be physically present in open courts, but in light of the circumstances, because of the interest of this high-profile case or cases, I have unlocked the courtroom in case anybody could not access the Zoom invite or wanted to just come into the courtroom. They would still be required to wear a mask and still socially distance. This order is in place for the scheduled proceeding this morning. It will be reconsidered as we go throughout in case there's a news break. Public health data, directives, and advice may be issued. This order is as narrowly and tailored as possible to address the present health risks. No less restrictive alternative is available that will sufficiently protect the health of everybody in attendance and anybody present and physically in the courtroom. We discussed last Friday the order in which the court will hear argument. It was modified yesterday slightly. And we're going to start with the family and the attorneys for Demarius Butts. I'm not sure who's making argument, whether it's Ms. Baker or Mr. Levitt. How would you like your 20 minutes to be divided?
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Laron Baker for the family of Demarius Butts. And we'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right. You may begin now.
Great. Good morning. As I just said, my name is Laron Baker, and I, along with Adrian Levitt, represent the family of Demarius Butts. It is my understanding that his mother, Ann Butt, and at least one of his siblings is also present for this hearing, so I want to acknowledge their
Thank you.
Presence here. Damaris Butts was born on July 14, 1997. His 23rd birthday would have been just 4 days ago. He moved to King County when he was 3 years old and lived here his entire life. He's the eldest of five children, three sisters, and two brothers, all of whom miss him dearly. His daughter, Delilah, was born on Christmas Eve in 2015 and was just over a year when he was killed. At the time of his death, he worked as a full-time forklift operator, had his own apartment, and was enrolled in GE classes at Highline Community College. On April 20th, 2017, Damaris and his sister shoplifted snacks from a 7-Eleven store in downtown Seattle and flashed a gun on their way out of the store. The Seattle Police Department officers responded in full force, sending officers from across town to search for Mr. Butts. Soon, officers located him, and six officers chased him into a loading dock, where he was soon cornered in a locked room. He was shot and killed by officers Kennedy, Gordillo, Viaga, and Myers. He was 20 years old. And like Isaiah Ovitt and Sherlyn Anat Lyles, Damaris Butts was a Black King County community member. We are not here to make determinations or factual findings about the death of Mr. Butts, Isaiah Ovitt, or Charlena Miles. We are here today to ensure that there's a meaningful and thorough public investigation into their deaths and into the law enforcement-driven investigation of their deaths. This is consistent with what the public demands. Our country, our local community, in the streets and in city council meetings, are demanding an end to the longstanding scourge of police violence that disproportionately targets Black, Indigenous, and people of color. Our community is also demanding a complete change in how we approach policing and how we hold police accountable for actions. As an amicus brief filed by Nikita Oliver and signed on 32 community organizations note, in King County, Black community members are nearly eight times more likely to be killed by police than white community members. And if King County were a state, only Utah would have greater racial disparities. King County residents are tired and outraged by police violence, its impact on BIPOC King County residents. And until law enforcement stops using deadly force against community members, King County residents want to ensure that there's a full, fair, and transparent review of each and every use of deadly force in King County by law enforcement, who are acting in our name and with the authority given to them. Executive Dow Constantine created such a process with changes that he made to the inquest back in 2018. The inquest process, it allows for a public investigation of all law enforcement use of deadly force in King County. Up until recently, the families were not automatically represented, and up until recently, there was not an opportunity for the parties to obtain information prior to the inquest hearing or that trial to begin. The changes that Executive Dow Constantine made were the result of community concerns that were raised about the fact that the prior inquest process was really insufficient for a thorough vetting of the use of deadly force. Now the families have assigned public defenders if they are unable to find their own attorney and can engage in pre-inquest discovery. However, there were parts of Executive Constantine's inquest process that simply didn't go far enough, and some of which were actually in contravention to state law. And that is why the families of Damaris Butts, Isaiah Ovitt, and Charlena Lyles are all here. And we want to ensure that the inquest process fulfills its promise, both to the families who have current inquest pending and moving forward. And so we believe that writs and mandamus are necessary in order to ensure that these processes, the inquest process, complies with the law and is actually able to be a full vetting of what occurred leading up to the death of loved ones. So in January of this year, the family of Damaris Butts filed a writ of mandamus
seeking to require the inquest process to allow for the subpoenaing of officers who use deadly force and in the inquest hearing. Under the rules that were initially developed by Executive Constantine, there was a bar on the inquest administrator actually subpoenaing any of the officers involved in the killing of a community member. So any of the officers who would actually have the most pertinent information for an inquest, the inquest administrator was barred from requiring them to participate in the inquest process and provide testimony or take the stand. This is in direct conflict with state law. RCW 3624050 requires that a coroner or a person acting as a coroner in an inquest summon and examine anyone with information regarding the death of an individual that's at the core of an inquest. And clearly an officer who killed an individual using the authority granted to them by the jurisdiction in which they work for would have information. In fact, there's no credible argument that the officers who killed an individual would know what occurred and would have information that's necessary to be vetted in an inquest. RCW 3624050 creates a mandatory obligation. The language in it says that the coroner must call anyone with information. It is not a discretionary decision. It is a requirement in an inquest. And because of that, there is a mandatory duty both on Dow Constantine and on Administrator Spearman and any other subsequent administrator to actually subpoena and examine all officers who use deadly force when that use of deadly force is subject to an inquest. This meets the requirements for the issuance of a writ of mandamus. There is a mandatory non-discretionary duty. One must call those who have information about the death. And it's non-discretionary. While there is part, and I believe the county makes this argument and law enforcement may make this argument, that built into 3624050 is an initial discretionary threshold. The inquest administrator must determine that an individual has actual knowledge of the death. The county and law enforcement argue that that discretion eviscerates the mandatory obligation of the statute, and they are incorrect. There may be an initial discretionary decision that's made that triggers the mandatory obligation, right? So once an administrator makes the determination that an individual has information regarding the death, the decision to summon and examine them is no longer discretionary. It is a requirement. And that's in general. And every single law enforcement officer who uses deadly force would have that knowledge. But specifically here, Administrator Spearman actually identifies that the officers who killed Damaris Butt have information that is critical for the inquest process to proceed in a meaningful way. And this is not surprising. The question around whether or not the officers who killed Damaris Butt would testify was a core part of all of the pre-inquest litigation or advocacy that occurred. Under the initial rules, when we first started the inquest proceeding, the officers were simply allowed to choose whether or not they wanted to testify, and regardless of whether or not they wanted to testify, they would have counsel present during the inquest proceeding. Obviously, the family sought to challenge that and sought to require to have the officers testify, and if they weren't testifying, then to not have their attorneys present in the actual inquest hearing. And ultimately, Administrator Spearman ruled against us and said that officers could participate and could have counsel present regardless of whether or not they provided testimony. He felt bound by the executive order. And ultimately, the officers who killed Damaris Butt determined that they would not testify at the inquest hearing. which was somewhat shocking because the officers who killed Damaris Butt had actually made multiple public statements and detailed statements about the death of Damaris Butt. They, in fact, recorded a video for a Seattle Police Department banquet where they went into extreme detail about what occurred leading up to the killing and what occurred in the loading dock where they killed Damaris Butt. And they did that for a Seattle Police Department banquet, but when it came to a public review of his death, these officers refused to testify. And Administrator Spearman ultimately found that their knowledge was critical, but that he could not compel them because he was barred from doing so under the executive order. 2 days before, 2 business days before the inquest started, while we were in the middle of a deposition, Executive Constantine issued a new executive order that required officers to testify if they were going to have counsel present in the inquest proceedings. That began a significant amount of challenges. All of these writs that are currently pending came out of that really last-minute decision. We filed these lawsuits in January, so the executive has been on notice that of all of the claims that are before before the court, and as you know, there are quite a few of them. So the executive has known about the family's argument that RCW 3624050 requires an administrator to call officers to testify. I hate to interrupt.
You got about 2 minutes of your first 15.
The executive waited until a handful of days before our responses were due to issue a new executive order allowing the inquest administrators to subpoena officers to provide testimony. As such, any argument that our lawsuit is moot because of this last-minute change is unavailing. The executive has shown it's willing to change rules at the last minute for gamesmanship, and then the executive also has denied that RCW 3624050 actually legally requires it to allow administrators to subpoena officers who have information about the death. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. You have 5 minutes remaining. You can mute yourself. I am not going to be asking questions because I want the parties to be able to articulate and utilize their full 20 minutes. I may have questions later, but I want to take all the arguments in. The briefing has been coming in rampantly. We are now moving on to the attorney for the family of Isaiah Obet, Ms. Parker. First, let me ask you, Ms. Parker, how many minutes would you like to reserve?
5. Thank you, Your Honor.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Good morning. Your Honor, I'm counsel for the family of Isaiah Obet, and I wanted the court to know that Sherlina and Slaughter Obet, Slaughter is the brother of Isaiah, and Sherlina is his sister-in-law, are also present. Your Honor, we stand here united with the family of Damaris Butts and the family of Charlene Lyles seeking mandamus relief. We joined the Butts writ, and we filed a collective response to the law enforcement writs. Our writ that we brought on behalf of the family of Isaiah Obet is a single-issue writ, seeking the court mandate that the executive and the administrator are required to submit the question of whether Officer Nelson acted with criminal means when he killed Isaiah Obet. Since 2011, the Auburn Police Department has killed 5 community members. 3 of those 5 have been killed by Officer Nelson. Officer Nelson has 65 use of force reports since 2011. These reports, as I've highlighted in my pleadings, document a pattern of violent and aggressive force against community members. Jeff Nelson has tattooed on his body, better to be judged by 12 than carried by 8. Jeff Nelson remains employed as a police officer in Auburn. When an officer in Auburn, Fegaway, Kent, Renton, or Tukwila, or Port of Seattle kill somebody in the line of duty, Valley Investigative Team investigates, known as VIT. As your Honor knows, I'm a public defender. I investigate criminal cases, and I also investigate police routinely. I have substantial experience evaluating their investigations. I get their use of force history. I get their disciplinary history. I interview them. I cross-examine them. At the VIT binder, which is a summary of the investigation, which summarized the investigation into the killing of Isaiah Obet, I could not believe this was a homicide investigation. If anything, in reading through it, it seemed to be an investigation to try to dispute or disprove that a homicide had occurred. After VIT does their investigation, they give it to the prosecutor. The prosecutor reviews it and makes a determination, in this case of non-filing, and then it goes to the inquest. In this case, the prosecutor's determination was that they found insufficient probable cause that the crime had been committed, and they did not file charges. Police investigating police is what VIT is. And then the prosecutor rubber stamping that poor investigation. This is where the inquest becomes vital and is key for the community. Let me tell you what was not in this investigation. There was no crime scene reconstruction expert who went to the scene and evaluated Officer Nelson's statement to see if it comported with the physical evidence. There's no in-car videos given from the dozens of officers who responded. And in this case, they responded within seconds of the homicide. None of those were given to VIT. The only one that was given was Officer Nelson's, and his sound was turned off. There was no use of force or no disciplinary history in the VIT binder. There was no information that Officer Nelson had killed someone prior to the killing of Isaiah Obet. And there was no information that he had killed someone after. None of that was in the information that the prosecution reviewed and that the police investigated. Moreover, Your Honor, throughout this process, Auburn did not hand over any of that information willingly. We had to obtain all of that through our investigation, through the inquest process. On those cams from the other officers who responded moments after Isaiah was killed was an entirely different statement that Officer Nelson had given than the one he'd given 6 days later in a room after he talked to his lawyers, after he had prepared for that statement. And that first statement was substantially different than the second. In that statement, Officer Nelson admits to first sending his canine to attack Isaiah, then shooting Isaiah in the chest. And then in that statement, Officer Nelson admits that while Isaiah was on his way to the ground, he shot him in the head. The second statement had a totally different version. Officer Nelson said that Isaiah was on his way up when he shot him in the head. Officer Nelson said he didn't ever send the dog throughout the whole encounter. It only happened after Isaiah was shot and killed. VIT didn't go after any of those cams and look at that information. The prosecutor didn't have that information when they made their determination of violence. Through our investigation, we were able to uncover that there were 3 homicides by Officer Nelson out of the 5. Again, this isn't something that Auburn handed over to us. In fact, Your Honor, Officer Nelson killed Jesse Saray on May 31st, 2019. We didn't discover it until December. We didn't even know until December of 2019. And we had been in at least two hearings with Auburn in front of the administrator, and no one mentioned it. No one thought that that might be an important piece of information to review or to mention to the administrator. An instrument, the inquest, that had historically gone dormant with the advent of modern policing and modern investigations, has now had new life breathed into it. And the reason is because of the unchecked power that is our current policing in King County. As counsel for Butts referenced, and as was written in the amicus, Black community members in King County are 8 times more likely to be killed than whites. If the inquest does not have teeth, if it isn't a real investigative tool, then it will just be like the prosecutor, and it will rubber stamp a poor investigation, and no officers will ever be accountable if they break the law. It is important that this court mandate that the question of criminal means go to the jury, that the court sustain the executive order and allow the review of disciplinary history and use of force history, that the court continue to allow the use of independent experts and affirm the ability for the administrator to subpoena witnesses who have relevant information, the death. Not only does the law require all these things, state law requires it, but, Your Honor, it gives validity to the community for these investigations. It takes a process that is fraught with problems, investigation, prosecutors, judging, police conduct, and it puts it in independent review that is removed from those intimate relationships between those law enforcement agencies. The family of Isaiah Obed asserts that the jury should be allowed to answer the question of whether his death was with criminal means. First, state law requires it, and second, case law makes it clear that it cannot be truncated from the process. But most importantly, Your Honor, the community needs it. I cited in my brief the relevant statutory authority that the court has to rely on. RCW 3624070 requires criminal means. The statute has 3 parts, Your Honor. The first part reads, after hearing the testimony, the jury shall render its verdict and certify the same in writing, signed by the jurors. That is a general application to the next 2 clauses in the statute. This is a statutory instruction question for the court. The second clause reads, and setting forth who the person killed is, if known, and when, where, and by what means he or she came to his death. The third clause reads, or if he or she was killed, or his or her death was occasioned by the act of another by criminal means, who is guilty thereof, if known. Those are the questions that the jury has to answer, not the coroner, not the administrator, not the prosecutor, not VIT. The jury answers those questions. Now, when you look at the second clause, Your Honor, the second clause is useful in cases when there's a dispute about who was killed or how they came to their death. For example, we're talking about suicides or missing persons cases. That second clause is very important in those cases to determine if there was an actual death. The second clause and the second part applies to cases where we know who died. We know they were killed. And what we want to know is, was that killing by criminal means? If you read through some of the cases that we've cited, BNSF and Carrick, the facts illuminate these 2 different clauses and why they're important. BNSF, for example, is the case of someone getting run over by a train. In that case, they knew who was killed. They knew how the person was killed. The question was the train conductor negligent when they killed that person? That is when the third clause comes into play. In Carrick v. Locke, it's a more interesting dynamic of facts. In Carrick v. Locke, it was a shoplift that had gone wrong, and security guards tackled the man. They tackled him and waited for police, and then police arrived, put him in a chokehold, and he died of asphyxiation. The question in that case, actually, is two parts. So both clauses in the statute matter. We want to know, who killed him? Was it security guards? Or was it the officers? Or was it a combination of both? And we want to know, was that by criminal means? So in that inquest, had the jury had that question, which they didn't, both of those inquiries are important. 3624040 says the jury is sworn to render a true verdict. And 3624070 is that verdict. You have other portions of the statute, 3624080, 090, 100, and they talk about when murder and manslaughter are supposed, what happens next? They talk about what to do if the person's in custody or out of custody. What is the purpose of those statutes if criminal means is something that can just be truncated from 3624? It would be superfluous, which we know. The court has to look at the whole section and cannot exclude other portions of the statute. Historically, prior to 1985, the criminal means question was always part of an inquest. And it's always been part of an inquest.
2 minutes.
We know in Franklin County, as I cited in my brief, the killing of Mr. Zambrano Montes, that's the question they asked. And we know prior to 1985 that Larry Eugene Ward, that they asked that question of the jury. So the executive has recently removed this part of the inquest, but its continued removal violates state law, and it must stop today. And, Your Honor, I know you have a mountain of briefing in front of you, and I don't necessarily envy your task. However, I think that the more challenging questions have a very simple solution. And I think the simple solution is Carrick v. Locke. And what Carrick v. Locke tells you is it says, look down 3624. And see if there's a conflict with the executive order. And if there is no conflict with the executive order, the executive is free to act. And that makes sense. He can make the process more community-centric, more police-centric. He can make it more reliable. He can make it more consistent. He can make it more efficient. He can do all those things as long as it does not conflict with state law. Your Honor, in this case, by removing criminal means from an inquest, that's the fundamental purpose of the whole mechanism. And he can't do it. He went too far. He contradicted the statute. He contradicted multiple sections of the statute. And he violated state law. Your Honor, mechanisms, disciplinary history, experts, all of those things are necessary. And none of them conflict with 3624. None of them. And so he can allow those things. In conclusion, Your Honor, I went into the facts of my case at length, and the reason that we did that is because while this is a statutory construction argument, the facts matter. This case represents what should be law enforcement's worst nightmare and the community's worst nightmare. And the fact that this officer has been over and over and over not held accountable for his conduct is alarming. There's another side of the story, though, however, Your Honor. And the other side of the story is if an officer, God forbid, has to kill a community member, and that was justified, the inquest will also ring that bell for the community and let the community know that, in fact, that killing was justified. And that could heal a lot of wounds. So, Your Honor, in conclusion, our community deserves the answer to this question, and the family of Isaiah Obet, his mother, his siblings, his nieces and nephews all deserve to know. But most importantly, the law demands it. Thank you.
Counsel, you have 4 minutes remaining. You ran over, but I didn't want to interrupt.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Ms. Parker. Next, we have the attorneys for the maternal family of Charlena Lyles, not the personal representative. And I believe it's Ms. Dave and Mr. Gilmeth. How much time would you like to reserve?
Yes, Your Honor. We would like to reserve 9 minutes for a very specific amount of time.
All right, Mr. Gilmeth, you may start.
Good morning, Your Honor. Good morning. For the record, Corey Gilmeth on behalf of the maternal family of Charlena Lyles. Before I start, I want to recognize the family members of Charlena Lyles who are present today. Katrina Johnson, Tanya Isabel, Monika Williams are all present. The families of Isaiah Obet, Demarius Butts, and Charlena Lyles joined together to present this court with two narrowly drawn requests for relief. The families only ask for relief clearly supported in statute and case law. The families' arguments are so strong that the county has already modified the inquest executive order in response to one, officer subpoenas. Although the families' arguments are not moot, as explained in the Butts and Lyles replies, the executive's actions clearly speak to the strength of the families' arguments. In contrast, law enforcement asks this court to take the unprecedented step of issuing 15 separate writs of prohibition. In doing so, they seek nothing less than to destroy the critical role of King County's inquest process. Lacking any particularly strong claim for relief, they have chosen to attack any feature of the inquest process they simply don't like. The kitchen sink approach taken by law enforcement belies the seriousness of the inquest process. We are here today because Charlena Lyles needed help. Instead, she was killed, ending her life and the life of her unborn child. Charlena Lyles' life matters. The inquest into her death matters. Not just for her children, siblings, and family, but for us all. Unfortunately, being a resident of King County, Ms. Lyles was especially likely to meet the fate that she did. In King County, our Black neighbors are nearly 8 times more likely to be killed by the police than our white neighbors. If King County were a state, as other counsel has explained, it would be second only to Utah in the disproportionality with which lives are taken, Black lives are taken by the police. In recent weeks, thousands of King County residents have signed petitions demanding that the county and law enforcement agencies support an inquest process that complies with state law. A multiracial group of 32 community organizations have written an amicus brief, joining families in making a similar request that King County's inquest process comply with state law. The public deserves and demands answers. The 15 writs sought by law enforcement will deny the public answers, continuing a shameful history that devalues the value of Black lives like Charlena Lyles's. The families come before this court seeking a writ of mandamus. A writ of mandamus shall issue when 3 elements are satisfied. First, a writ shall issue if a public official has violated non-discretionary legal duties. For the reasons explained by the Butts and Obet families, duties compelled under RCW 3624 have been violated, and thus the first element is satisfied. Second, a writ shall issue when there is no other plain, speedy, and adequate remedy. It is undisputed that an inquest ruling cannot be appealed. Similarly, a declaratory judgment cannot be used to compel specific actions. Instead, a declaratory judgment declares rights, status, and other legal relations. It simply would not afford the remedy sought, compliance with state law. In fact, the Washington Supreme Court affirmed that writ relief is the only available relief in inquest just last year. Although that case, BNSF, concerned a writ of prohibition, the standard for writ of prohibition is the same as for mandamus. In BNSF, the court wrote, because decisions surrounding coroner inquests may not be directly appealed or set aside by the court, BNSF did not have an adequate remedy in the course of legal procedure satisfying the second prong. Third, a writ shall issue when a party has a beneficial interest. The beneficial interest exists when a party has an interest in the action beyond that shared with other citizens. King County's own actions recognize that families have beneficial interests in inquest proceedings, interests so strong that the county has chosen to protect them with its own resources. In 2018, King County passed an ordinance guaranteeing all families inquest representation at public expense. Just last month, the county passed an ordinance to enshrine this right in the county charter. The county's decision that a modification to the county's foundational document, the charter, was necessary to protect family interests in inquest proceedings clearly demonstrates that families have an interest in inquest proceedings beyond that shared in common with other citizens. Finally, I want to briefly address the specific claim that a writ action can only be filed by the personal representative of misfiles of the state. Such a claim is entirely unsubstantiated. The officers in raising their claim cite no statutes or court decisions to support this argument, because there are none. The structure of misfiles of the state has simply no relevance to the inquest investigation into her death. And finally, before I set aside the balance of my time for rebuttal, I also want to address the argument that several inquests, including Ms. Lyles, is our time barred. The Lyles inquest is not time barred because the 18-month time frame is directory, not mandatory. For statutes such as RCW 36-24020 that specify a time within which a public officer is to perform an official act regarding the rights and duties of others, the word shall is presumed to be directory. It is presumed to be directory unless either the language of the statute or the nature of the act makes clear that the designation of time limits the officer. Here, the language of the statute does not make clear any such limitation, since there is no language, in addition to the 18-month period itself, that could be seen as limiting the power of the coroner. So we turn to the nature of the act. In assessing the nature of the act, a statute is considered directory when it is merely a guide for the conduct of business and for orderly procedure, rather than a limitation of power. Here, there are four distinct reasons demonstrating that the 18-month time period is clearly intended as a guide for the conduct of business by facilitating cooperation between the coroner and the judicial branch. First, inquests by their very nature require an unusual amount of cooperation to facilitate the conduct of the hearing. Inquests require the cooperation of two independent branches of government, the judicial branch and the coroner, or in this case, which is the executive. The coroner must secure the collaboration of the judicial branch in finding a courtroom, obtaining a bailiff, obtaining a court reporter, arranging security, scheduling a date, and impaneling a jury, among other tasks. Second, SB 6295, the bill creating the 18-month period, was introduced in direct response to a breakdown in cooperation that prevented the conduct of business. In that case, an inquest hearing. In testimony to members of the Senate Law and Justice Committee, Senator Hasegawa, the legislation's prime sponsor, explained to other legislators that he introduced the bill in response to the Franklin County Superior Court's refusal to provide a courtroom and other resources to the coroner for the inquest of Antonio Zambrano Montes. In so doing, the 18-month period was intended to facilitate timely cooperation, not further limit coroner authority to conduct an inquest. Third, the statute considered as a whole is intended to facilitate orderly procedure. It is a core tenet of statutory interpretation that statutes must be read as a harmonious whole. Indeed, the 18-month period is situated in a paragraph that discusses collaboration between the coroner and superior court. The paragraph discusses scheduling a courtroom, obtaining a bailiff, obtaining a court reporter, obtaining security, and setting a date for the inquest. In fact, the sentence immediately preceding the 18-month period specifically discusses collaboration by referencing mutual agreement. Fourth and finally, interpreting the 18-month period as a limit on coroner authority would have dramatic negative consequences with very little, if any, positive benefit. When engaging a statutory interpretation, the court must consider the consequences that would result from constructing the particular statute in one way or another. Preventing families and the public from receiving the benefit of an inquest after several pre-inquest hearings and patient engagement with inquest reforms would cause substantial public harms. Canceling hearings would reduce transparency at a moment in time when calls for transparency are louder than they've ever been before.
1 minute, counsel.
In contrast, the purported benefits to timeliness of canceling inquest hearings are simply non-existent. The cities argue in their briefing that the 18-month time period is a statute of limitations to ensure inquest hearings will occur in a timely manner. The problem with that argument is it's wrong. The coroner controls when the 18-month period begins through his or her request to the court. So mandatory construction of the 18-month period would actually establish no limit on how long after the death the inquest could occur. If the legislature intended a statute of limitations, as the cities claim, it would have written one. It knows how to do so and does so frequently. It didn't hear, and that is telling. Curiously, the only other argument of legislative intent raised by the cities actually undermines their own argument. The cities argue that because a previous version of the bill said an inquest, quote, must take place within a certain period of time, the 18-month period limits coroner authority. However, as the cities point out, the language was stricken and replaced with the word shall. And the word shall is directory when it directs the official to perform an act within a certain period of time that concerns the rights and duties of others. The legislature would have known this. As a result, this change reflects that the legislature modified the bill so that it would be interpreted as directory. Even assuming, for the sake of argument, that the 18-month timeframe was a strict limit, Ms. Lyles' inquest is still not time-barred, because the time period did not begin until July 2019. RCW 3624020 states that the period begins when the coroner notifies the Superior Court to provide persons to serve as a jury. The executive's 2017 request was sent to the District Court, and it was for a judge to be assigned, not a jury. His request was simply a procedural request to begin pre-inquest hearings and not the request envisioned under the statute. Even if we go one step further, even if the cities were right that the executive's 2017 request was to the Superior Court for a jury, only 302 days would have elapsed. That is because the city's calculation ignores a hold placed on Ms. Lyles' inquest hearing in 2018 during the executive's inquest review process. The executive, as the coroner, is authorized to put a hold on inquest proceedings. However, the hold was not, as the cities claim in their reply, simply an informal pause by the executive. A hold was also placed by the court. The court docket in Ms. Lyles' inquest reads, and I quote, pre-inquest hearing canceled, hold placed on conducting of inquests until further review of policies and procedures. As a result, even ignoring the clear evidence that the 18-month period is directory, Ms. Lyles' inquest is not time-barred. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
You have 7 minutes, counsel, remaining. Next is Mr. Estes on behalf of the City of Auburn, City of Kent, and the Special Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County Sheriff's Office. Mr. Estes, how much time would you like to reserve? You need to unmute yourself. Mr. Estes?
Yes, Your Honor. I was clicking the wrong button on the screen. I apologize.
Not a problem. How much time?
I would like to start off with 17 minutes and reserve 3, although I may finish sooner than that.
Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stu Estes, I represent the City of Auburn, I'm associated with the City of Federal Way, also Kent, King County Sheriffs in the City of Renton, and with us online are various city attorneys, chiefs, and mayors, and other interested city officials. Ms. Miller and I are going to split our issues up. I'm going to begin with the discovery subpoena issue, appearance of fairness doctrine, the limits on executive authority, and discuss some of the King County charter limits. We are, Your Honor, portrayed as the villain here, as opposing police reform, and I want to state clearly, as I did in our briefs, that that is not the situation. We do not oppose accountability reform, and in fact, our officers have, for the last 30 years, waived their Fifth Amendment rights and gone into these inquests and testified prior to the prosecutor making a decision on whether to charge them with murder. There are a number of conversations we've had over the years about the officers asking why they were going to do that. And we've always talked about accountability and clarity, and we've been doing that for the years and years that the inquest process has been in a form which conforms with the Coroner's Act. And we also support an independent and a uniform review statewide, and I think the best thing this court could do would be to end this process and send us all to Olympia to work on a statewide process that's not a piecemeal process through 39 counties, some of which will may have it, some of which won't, using the Coroner's Act of 1854, which is basically copied from an English bill written in the 1700s. It is archaic, and life is not breathed into a statute that is never meant to do this. And we know the Executive Constantine has stated clearly in his most recent press release that the whole process here is so that departments can be held accountable for creating better, safer ways of policing. But he's the coroner. He's wearing the coroner's hat when he does these inquests, and that he's not responsible for police reform. This has a unique purpose, and that is to assist the medical examiner in reaching those decisions. So, turning to the issue of authority for discovery subpoenas, I think that will assist us in understanding some of the delegation and underlying authority arguments that we're making here. Initially, the executive claims that no one can challenge a subpoena until they're served with a subpoena and about to be dragged into an inquest a few days later, and then they have to go to Superior Court and seek relief there. I don't think that makes a great deal of sense. BNSF case granted a writ of prohibition for a subpoena that was in excess of the medical examiner's authority, and there's plenty of authority in our briefing to show that this action is appropriate, whether for declaratory and injunctive relief and for prohibition. The issue of a discovery subpoena, and that's essentially a subpoena issued prior to the inquest process, and that is found only in the King County Code. It was delegated to the chief medical examiner. That's the words in the code. No one else, not the coroner, which might lead to an argument that the executive, using the coroner's authority, could issue the subpoena, but that's not the case. The county council was very clear. They said the chief medical examiner was by code, a different official. And that is for, quote, investigation of any case under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. So the executive has no discovery subpoena authority to delegate under the county code. And I want to go back and discuss some of the underlying principles, but the executive order under responsibilities states upon request by an administrator, the prosecuting attorney issues subpoenas for witnesses and documents. So the executive's order does not follow the county code because it says that the chief medical examiner may issue subpoenas, and the executive order, which was written well before the legislative amendment, talks about the prosecuting attorney issuing these subpoenas. There is one issue with the executive brief claims that the pro tem attorney also has authority to issue subpoenas. I think that's a misreading of the order because the section 8.5, which I just read about the prosecutor, is very clear and it's more specific. But in any event, neither the pro tem attorney nor the prosecuting attorney have authority to issue subpoenas for depositions. There was no authority in the executive to delegate to anyone. And this all lies based on constitutional principles. The county code deprived the executive of all the coroner's duties except for holding the inquest. What happens is the executive order is usurping that pre-inquest subpoena power. What does the Washington Constitution say about this? Essentially, the executive cannot enact laws. It can only implement those that are granted by the council. And the executive briefs recognize. What is the constitutional authority of county officers? It's set forth clearly in the Leibovitz Amendment 21. But what's happened here is we have an executive order that's not based on the Coroner's Act. And in a case brought against Fisher McReynolds versus Cosim some years ago, the court said an executive order that's not based on a legislative grant of authority lacks the force and effect of law. Presidential executive orders are subject to the same analysis as President Trump has frequently found out recently. County powers are also so limited. And Carrick, which we were all discussing as a very significant case here, describes the Constitution as providing all responsibilities placed on county officials by general statutes. So general statutes, including the Coroner's Act. So all responsibilities placed on county officials by the Coroner's Act will accrue to the county legislative authority in Home Rule County. And this is very dry civics lesson that I've spent the last few weeks trying to untangle. But basically, there is a bucket of authority by which a home rule county accepts these powers from the general statutes. It all goes to the legislature, except for the prosecutor and the judiciary, which we're not talking about here. So all the authority from the Coroner's Act or any other general statute goes to this bucket that is the county councils to divvy up as they choose. And the Constitution says exactly what Carrick says. All the powers, authority, and duties granted by general law shall be vested in the legislative authority, except if it's done by charter. The charter did not create a coroner. It only said an inquest shall be held. It didn't say by whom. And it did create a Department of Public Health to perform autopsies, but it did not vest any inquest authority in the executive. So those authorities, the authority to conduct that is only from the Coroner's Act to the executive by way of the county council enacting a code, and that was not done here. The Constitution and the King County Charter both talk about delegation. The Constitution says the legislative authority may delegate any of its executive powers. So it recognizes that it receives the powers of the executive that aren't set forth in the charter. And then the charter itself says it can establish, abolish, and combine and divide up any duties and any offices as it sees fit. It can slice and dice and dole things out as the people of the county in a home rule wish. And so the executive powers here are limited only to that one clause in two sections of the code, which is the same language, that all the medical examiner's powers, the medical examiner has all the powers set forth in the Coroner's Act, except for the holding of inquest, which function is vested in the county executive. So that's his singular authority. On the other hand, the medical examiner's powers are to perform statutory coroner's duties. That's in section 050 of the code. The medical examiner shall be responsible for the investigations of deaths, which is important on the pre-inquest subpoena issue. The executive simply does not have the free-roaming authority that he claims in his brief, that even if it wasn't delegated to him, there's some generic Coroner's Act responsibilities and duties that he has. That's just simply not the case under home rule county law. So the pre-inquest subpoena issue is part of our argument as to the appearance of fairness is that this has turned into an extravagant, adversarial, two-week, and maybe some of these may go three-week trials, where we have months of pretrial depositions and discovery, we have expert witnesses, we have open and closing statements, we have far-ranging issues as to training, discipline, and policies. And these subpoenas will be issued if the court allows us delegation to occur, and will turn these things into what they were intended, a far-reaching adversarial process. So the language in the executive order, again, says the prosecuting attorney issues subpoenas, and that language predates BNSF and the 2019 amendment. So the order was not even contemplating the question of pretrial subpoenas. It was written before that authority ever existed. No coroner in Washington history has ever had the authority to issue pre-inquest subpoenas, as the Pierce County Medical Examiner found out the hard way in BNSF versus Clark. The court there held subpoena power does not arise until there's a matter pending before a tribunal. So the legislative fix was in response to that holding, and so it was clearly to allow the coroner to issue subpoenas before he or she asked the Superior Court to convene an inquest. These are subpoenas that can only be issued by the medical examiner. The legislature said, and as I indicated, the coroner or the medical examiner in King County has the jurisdiction for death investigations. The county council designated that clearly to that office. The legislative fix to BNSF states that the coroner may, in the course of an active or ongoing death investigation, request the Superior Court to issue subpoenas. Now, that doesn't track the executive order at all, and it doesn't track the county code. The charter is silent on it, and the code just says the chief medical examiner may issue subpoenas for the full investigation of any case under the jurisdiction of the medical examiner. So, again, the code is even more restrictive than the statute. And so the executive, acting as a coroner, has no pre-inquest subpoena power to delegate to the inquest administrator, the prosecutor, or the pro tem attorney. So there's simply no discovery subpoena power under the executive order. And we would ask that injunctive relief, declaratory relief, and a writ of prohibition be issued as to that issue. Related is the executive's power to expand the scope of the Coroner's Act, which, as I indicated, was enacted in 1854, 35 years before we were even a state, based on an English act that was revised substantially a few years later. And so we adopted it in whole before it was even overhauled by the Brits. And it's basically a 1700 eras statute that really isn't well equipped to do what the executive wants here. There can be statutory authority for this. We can do a number of other things for police reform and accountability, but this is, the Coroner's Act is an ill vessel into which to put this. And as the Spokane County Medical Examiner has written in an article on his website entitled Why Modern Medical Examiners Don't Hold Inquests, it's antiquated. It's not a medical proceeding. It's a political proceeding. And that's why hardly any jurisdiction in the United States does or has attempted to hold inquests in this area. So some basic principles: the executive branch official cannot legislate, and that office only has the authority delegated to them. And that's very clear in a case that we've cited in our brief, DeRocher versus King County. It involves the home rule issues, and we cited it, didn't discuss it in full, and I want to just take a little bit of time here to say what it's about. And it essentially holds that anything that's not specifically given to an executive department is maintained by the county council. And there was an issuance of a conditional use permit, which was expressly allowed by the charter, but the code talked about unclassified use permits, and the charter didn't expressly delegate that, nor did a code revision. So the court held that this is a exciting case of Weyerhaeuser wanting a permit for a gravel pit that the neighbors opposed. But essentially, the question was who had the power to grant this certain type of permit. And the county council did, and that was held to be correct because it had not delegated that authority to the planning department. So DeRocher stands for the proposition under Article 11, Section 4, that unless something is very clearly and specifically delegated to an executive office, it does not have that authority. And simply turning a two-day inquest into this adversarial civil trial is beyond the scope of what the executive has been delegated under the Coroner's Act. And turning to the appearance of fairness doctrine, it applies to quasi-judicial proceedings. When the agency employed procedures that create the appearance of unfairness, or when the members of the decision-making bodies have apparent conflicts of interest. Now here, we have arguments as to the unfair procedures. We believe that the order was created behind closed doors, and I've set that out in my opening brief, and I contacted Mr. Gilmet before I filed that brief, and I told him the argument I was gonna make, and I assured him that I made no allegation of impropriety against him, and I'll repeat that now. The problem we see it as is there's a misunderstanding of roles here. I expected Mr. Couple's name or Ms. Canner's name to be the author of that document. I was kind of surprised that that happened. There's also substantive bias written into the order against law enforcement about the participation without counsel and testimony, past discipline, no self-defense, and the chief can't testify on their behalf. The executive has overturned administrative rulings, as we've heard from both sides, and twice amended the executive order. So all of us are going into proceedings where we don't even know what the rules will be shortly before they start. And that's not how, that's not a fair process to be in. The second issue in terms of fairness is that the presiding officer is an at-will employee of the executive, can be fired for any reason. And we've talked about how these administrators have the fortitude to stand up to this changing sands and mixed messages that the executive is sending, but not everyone will be so strong going forward. So the response to that is that this is an executive investigation, and it's not quasi-judicial. I could just read from Executive Order 3.1, where it says the proceedings are quasi-judicial in nature. So that's the executive's own words. Carrick applied the appearance of fairness doctrine to a much lesser judicial proceeding that existed back in the 1990s. And Carrick also said that although the general nature of inquest is investigatory, coroners have been described as acting in a judicial capacity and presiding over such proceedings. So in response to this, the executive says that a case called Peterson has overruled Carrick and said that the appearance of fairness doctrine no longer applies. If you look at the footnote in Peterson, that's not what it says at all. It is quoting from Carrick, or relying upon Carrick, for the proposition that the appearance of fairness process doctrine does not apply to the prosecutor. That's all Peterson says. That's all Carrick said. Carrick placed limits on who can be this independent person. The issue in Carrick was the separation of powers and the delegation and whether delegating executive authority to the judicial branch violated the separation of powers and interfered with the jurisdiction of the court. And the Supreme Court said no. It would be best to have someone not under the executive's direct control to do that. The
1 minute of your 17.
The election of the sheriff does not change anything here, Your Honor. The appearance of fairness doctrine applies to bias for and against. The issue in Carrick was whether the district judge or the person assigned to preside might be under the executive's thumb and have bias for law enforcement, which, as my clients would probably consider that the good old days. But here we have a situation where political elected officials are showing bias against law enforcement. So the appearance of fairness doctrine goes each way, either in favor of law enforcement or the other participants or against them. And so the executive sent a clear message to overrule the administrator, and those presiding officers have taken public positions on this. Again, the roles are very confused, and we just don't think this is the system in which we should be made to participate in. Thank you, Your Honor.
You have 2 minutes remaining, counsel. Next, we'll hear from Mr. Berrio, who is the attorney for Christopher Myers, Elizabeth Kennedy, Joshua Vaga, and Xavier Gordillo. Counsel, how much time?
Good morning, Your Honor. I don't intend to reserve any time. I will just reserve whatever time I end up having.
Okay, so you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I'd like to begin by getting into some comments that Ms. Baker made with respect to pre-inquest process of bus. As Ms. Baker noted, there were new rules that were issued by the executive 2 days before our inquest was scheduled to begin. Mr. Levitt, Ms. Baker, counsel for the city, Administrator Spearman, counsel for the officers, worked exceptionally hard for months leading up to the inquest, working through this new executive order, working through arguments, listening to Administrator Spearman's thoughts and process on this. And I bring this up because there are a lot of people from the public that are watching this right now. And the executive has gone out and indicated the officers are the ones who have held up this process. And the reality is, various buses in question were prepared to go forward. All the attorneys were ready to go forward, and it was going to move forward until the executive changed the rules. And the executive, again, has changed the rules more recently after these writs were filed. So I just want to get that out there. I also want to get a little bit into the facts of BUTS because the issues that I'm going to discuss are specific to BUTS and rulings that came out of that particular inquest. As Ms. Baker noted, this case involved a scenario where Mr. BUTS and his sister took snacks from a 7-Eleven. Mr. BUTS flashed a weapon at the 7-Eleven clerk, and law enforcement was called. Law enforcement confronted Mr. BUTS. Mr. BUTS fled. Law enforcement followed him. He was apprehended, and while apprehended, his sister, Adriana, assaulted an officer, at which point Mr. Butts then fled from that officer. Officers continued to chase Mr. Butts. They encountered him in the federal building. Once inside, Mr. Butts shot Officer Kennedy. She returned fire. other officers arrived on scene, and Mr. Butts fired his weapon again, shot Officer Kang. That bullet is still lodged in Officer Kang's chest to this day. Officers returned fire, and Mr. Butts was killed. And I bring those facts, again, as Ms. Baker noted in her argument, not to dispute the facts of this case, but just to give some understanding to some of the rulings that came out of the inquest that I'm going to address. The first issue I want to address is policy and training and its inclusion in the inquest process. The inquest was created to investigate the facts and circumstances of death. Policy, training do not elaborate on the facts and circumstances of death. And we know that because of what occurred in the Demaryius Butts inquest. And the issue that arose was what policy is going to be utilized in the inquest, what policy is going to be analyzed. And the argument that went back and forth was, well, who decides what the policy is? And certainly the city of Seattle, who participated in the inquest, said, well, the city's going to decide what policy was applicable. And family's argument was, well, we think there are other policies applicable. Well, that becomes obviously problematic because you're asking an inquest panel to answer a question. Did officers follow the applicable policy? Yet the family wants to submit policy that the city is saying was not applicable, that the officers were not trained to apply. So if that were to take place, and we have policy in front of an inquest panel that these officers were not trained to apply in the situation, they've been told is not applicable to the situation, and yet we're going to ask an inquest panel to determine its applicability, obviously what you're going to end up with is an error in findings, but more importantly, it's not a factual finding. It's an opinion as to whether or not they complied with the policy, which, as I've just noted, may not even apply to the scenario. And for that reason alone, the policy training issue is not intended to be baked into the inquest. Now, I want to make it crystal clear. I think that the public should be analyzing policy. I think the public should be analyzing training as a King County taxpayer, as a citizen of King County, I think that is incredibly important. But I think there are other ways to do it, and it doesn't necessarily have to come in the inquest process. You can have the inquest take that information and finding and convene a panel to go over those things. But doing it this way in the inquest process takes away from that original purpose. There's been some discussion about officers testifying and the subpoena authority of the executive. As Ms. Baker noted in her argument, this changed during our inquest. Originally, there was a question of whether the officers were going to testify, and it was a voluntary question. They were able to respond with yes or no. We may or may not testify, and that is something that has always been the case throughout the history of inquests. It's voluntary whether these officers testify. And then on the eve of the inquest, it was if the officers do not volunteer to testify, they are not entitled to counsel, which ultimately resulted in these writs being filed. Now the executive has changed that once again to say that the administrator has subpoena authority. The issue with that is you don't know exactly what that means, at least from the officer's perspective. Does that mean the administrator has authority to subpoena the officers? The administrator may have authority to subpoena the officers, but that doesn't mean that the officers have to get up on the stand and testify. And here's why. If this is an investigation, and that's what everyone has called this, an investigation, these officers are entitled to the same constitutional rights as anyone else. And just like any investigation that may result in a criminal charge, that may result in criminal culpability, you have a right to remain silent. And these public defenders are aware of that. Certainly, Adriana Butts, for example, in our case, if she hadn't been charged and she was being investigated, I guarantee the public defenders would say, no, she doesn't have to sit up there and provide testimony. And you know what? I would agree with them. I would agree that she would not have to get up there and assert her Fifth Amendment rights if she was being investigated at that time. No different than these officers. And they're entitled to that right. That's why it has always been voluntary whether or not they testify. Now, Administrator Spearman, the way that he dealt with that issue, if they were not going to testify, was to say, well, then we may utilize the officer's statements. As everyone is aware who is participating in the inquest, the officers, after this event, go through an interview process, and they are interviewed, and they are asked questions about the facts and circumstances of what occurred. And then Mr. Spearman decided, well, if they're not going to testify, then we may utilize that information. So the suggestion that the inquest cannot move forward without their testimony is simply false. There is information available, and it doesn't require a pre-inquest subpoena to interview these officers. It doesn't even require them to testify, and they're entitled to that right not to testify. Getting further into this issue of summoning and examining witnesses, I'll elaborate on Mr. Estes' argument. There is no authority for the administrator to issue pre-inquest subpoenas. And the primary reason they're not is the inquest is a public quasi-judicial proceeding. And I reiterate the word public. The whole reason is so that the public gets to hear all this information, so that when witnesses are questioned, it happens in public. It happens before the jury. So the investigation, as Mr. S. has pointed out, is done by the medical examiner. In fact, even when an inquest is initiated, it's because an investigation has concluded. Therefore, when the inquest starts, then yes, he can subpoena witnesses, and they can come and testify. And depending on the circumstances, as I've noted, they may or may assert a particular right not to testify. But that's the opportunity to do that. And importantly, all of the officers who are involved in this event, they're writing reports. They're giving information. So if counsel wants to cross-examine them or ask them about it, they do that in front of the inquest jury. That is what is indicated by the statute. In fact, the statute even allows the jury to ask questions. And historically, that is what the inquest jury has done. They ask questions. After counsel asks questions, they get to submit their questions, and then the court submits those to the witnesses. Last, I want to address an issue with respect to the administrator calling relevant witnesses. So in our case in particular, Adriana Butts was excluded from offering testimony. In fact, the administrator excluded the parties from even mentioning her name. This is important because the inquest is there to investigate the facts and circumstances of death. Yet the administrator had made the determination in that case that somehow Adriana Butts was not involved in the facts and circumstances of death. And the reasoning for that was that she was concerned that an inquest panel may determine that but for Adriana Butts' actions, her brother would not have been killed. And she felt that that may be prejudicial. But that's not the purpose of the inquest. The inquest purpose is not to determine whether or not it prejudices a particular party. The inquest purpose is to identify the facts and circumstances. And certainly, Adriana Butts' involvement is part of that. And again, I will reiterate, if she had subpoenaed Adriana Butts and she was under investigation, I think she would have a right not to testify under those circumstances. But certainly, she is required to subpoena witnesses who have that relevant information. And that would exceed the authority of the statute to then pick and choose and say, well, I think this is going to bias a party if I call this particular witness. This proceeding is not about bias to a particular party. It's about eliciting the facts and what actually happened. And therefore, the administrator has to follow that statutory directive. Last, I just want to address the appearance of fair and strict doctrine. Again, I want to point out that Administrator Spearman worked exceptionally hard in the Butts inquest to navigate this new executive order, to listen to the arguments of the parties, and to make well-thought-out determinations with respect to how the inquest is going to occur. And one of those decisions was that the officers, even if they did not elect to testify, would be entitled to counsel. And based on that decision that the administrator made, the executive went and changed the executive order 2 days before the inquest proceedings. And that goes to the heart of the appearance of fairness doctrine, is that the administrator is working under the thumb of the executive. And as has historically been done, these have been overseen by nine district court judges, so we maintain that independence. Administrator Spearman is employed by the executive. He has to do exactly what the executive says, and the only way to maintain that independence is by appointing someone to oversee this process who does not work under him, who has independent authority and discretion to make particular decisions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. You have 7 minutes remaining. Next is Ms. Cobb. She is the attorney for officers McNew and Anderson. Ms. Cobb, how much time would you like reserved, if any?
Seven minutes, Your Honor.
All right. Go ahead.
Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning.
Counsel.
And then just so you know, just so you know, we're going to take a break at the end of your 13 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
All of the counsel thus far for the officers have indicated that for decades, officers have been willing to engage in this process, disregarding the Fifth Amendment rights not to testify. When these hearings were being conducted as they were intended, as the Supreme Court has said over and over and over again, that these are fact-finding hearings. These are supposed to be a public airing of the facts so that there would be transparency for the public. And contrary to the belief of the families and their counsel, officers in the past have actually welcomed these processes because they allow the public to actually see and hear what officers deal with on a day-to-day basis, and for the most part, come away from those hearings with a new understanding of what the officers deal with. And oftentimes, they want to discuss that with the officers afterwards, and it generally tends to be a healing process for the officers and an educational and healing process for the public. I realize the families disagree with that, but that has been the case in the past. So the argument that they're trying to limit transparency in these matters is just not the case. In our current climate with the pervasive anti-enforcement attitude and activities, officers are understandably concerned about what they see as being targeted in this community, and especially in light of these groups trying to turn these hearings away from a fact-finding hearing and actually finding criminal liability, which would be completely inappropriate under the circumstances. As Mr. Estes commented, law enforcement doesn't disagree that there needs to be some police reform and has been voluntarily engaging in that process really heavily, especially over the last 5 or so years. I-940 was passed, which it's hardly even gotten a chance to take hold yet. That is the avenue by which the prosecutor has more discretion in charging decisions. In the city of Seattle, as an example, there is now a civilian-run Office of Police Accountability that investigates all allegations of misconduct, identifies systematic problems, and recommends changes. There is a new civilian-run community police commission, monitors training and implementation of policies to ensure they reflect community values. There's a civilian-run Office of the Inspector General who reviews the quality of OPA investigations, management practices, and policies to ensure maintenance of reforms brought about by, in particular, by the decree under which the SPD is currently operating. The reforms to the inquest process that the families are looking for are akin to a civil lawsuit. All of the things that they discuss, whether or not, you know, the training of the officers, the damages to families, whether or not the officer acted inappropriately so far. Those things are to be handled in, those are handled in criminal cases, they're handled in civil cases, and we're going so far off course with the inquest process that it's completely lost its underlying quality of being simply a public airing of the facts, not of the law. The families all claim to, in some way or the other, that the jury will be allowed to determine that the officer, whether or not the officer acted with malice, or that the jury will be instructed on the law and available defenses. Those comments alone indicate that this is no longer a fact-finding hearing. This is turned into a hearing in which there is being analysis of the law and of liability or lack thereof. This automatically turns these proceedings into an adversary process, which is the exact opposite of what it's supposed to be. Handing off to a jury the process of determining criminal liability is something that is left to a prosecutor that generally is a lawyer, has years of training, has lots of information, has all the investigative tools, and we expect, and sometimes these things take months, years to investigate before criminal charges are filed or not, when that determination is made. We expect a jury in what is supposed, which is generally in most inquests, a week or less process. We cannot expect a jury to obtain the in-depth type of information that is necessary in order to make those decisions, especially where officers are necessarily there's bias against them in the process wherein they take actions under policies and procedures that their departments set out for them. Their own chief or head of law enforcement of their agency is entitled to testify about those policies and procedures and training, but in a really odd turn of events, is now not able to testify whether or not that chief's officer acted within that policy and training. Instead, a civilian jury with zero experience with law enforcement and several days of testimony is expected to make that decision. And that's completely contrary to the rule of law and to the purpose of these procedures. We realize that the families have always claimed that these hearings are biased against them, in part because of the fact that they haven't been entitled to counsel, but they now are entitled to counsel, and we don't want to move the pendulum from being biased towards officers to being biased against them in ways that especially affect their constitutional rights. Just wanted to clarify the issue of standing as to the Lyles maternal family. We've never stated, and I think that Mr. Gamet clarified that, but we've not stated that we're objecting to standing of the of any family and any family member to engage in the inquest process. What we simply said is, under the law, under the law brought by a family for the benefit or on behalf of the decedent must be brought by the personal representative. That's always been the case, and that was our point, not that we objected or believed that there wasn't standing in order for them to engage in that process. That additional issues related to the criminal finding Sorry, I'm skipping around. I'm trying not to duplicate arguments of the other counsel for officers, Your Honor. Under the current procedure, juries are not allowed to determine whether or not the officer's state of mind, which is the all-important finding in all of these cases. What happened and why did it happen? What was in the officer's mind at the time that the use of lethal force was applied? And if an officer cannot testify and the jury cannot consider whether the officer legitimately feared for his life or for the life of others, then the process fails to have any meaning. I'll reserve the rest of my time, Your Honor.
You have 11 minutes remaining, counsel.
Thank you.
We're going to take a 15-minute recess. You're welcome to stay on the line. I have one person waiting. Let me admit her. we're going to take a 15-minute recess. I'm going to leave the line open. Just remember, unless you're speaking, you must remain muted. If you violate this, I mute you. So everyone's been great. So we'll resume at about 10:51 and a half. We're at recess.